Coming up, the election in Israel increases the power of hardliners while desperation and mutual accusations continue in Gaza. What are the chances now for Middle East peace? And the growth of open adoption. A mother decides to let her baby be adopted. She knows who the adoptive parents are, and she'll remain a part of that child's life. But is it right for her, for the child, for the adoptive parents? Plus, a worship service in Nigeria that blends Christianity and Islam. This pastor tells his people they're all children of Abraham.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As millions of Americans faced layoffs and foreclosures, Congress worked on a stimulus package, and the administration unveiled a plan to rescue the financial system. At the same time, religious leaders lobbied for limits on executive pay and more federal funds for food stamps and other programs for the poor. Meanwhile, President Obama pledged to review the controversial Pentagon policy that bans the news media from photographing coffins of the returning military dead. Though some photographs of coffins have surfaced, coverage was completely banned by the Bush administration. The Pentagon had argued that the ban protects privacy. Those who want the ban lifted argued that the images would illustrate for the public the true cost of war. The United Nations Human Rights Council has endorsed China's human rights record. The council issued a report Thursday with representatives of Cuba and Pakistan, among others, praising China. The favorable review came despite the fact that China rejected suggestions from council members to abolish the death penalty and dismissed accusations of police torture and prohibitions on religious freedom. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict XVI met with American Jewish leaders and assured them that the Catholic Church vehemently rejects anti-Semitism. The meeting came after the Pope was harshly criticized for reinstating an excommunicated bishop who denies the Holocaust. The Pope subsequently asked the bishop to recant. Benedict, who's German, told the Jewish leaders that he understands only too well the enormity of the Holocaust. The Shoah.
The hatred and contempt for men, women, and children that was manifested in the Shoah was a crime against God and against humanity.
Also, the Vatican confirmed that the Pope will travel to Israel in May. In the aftermath of Israel's incursion into Gaza, Amnesty International says there's evidence of war crimes by both sides during the fighting. Meanwhile, both Israel and Hamas are restricting the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Israel because it's concerned about arms smuggling, and Hamas because it wants more control over the aid. In Tuesday's Israeli elections, hardliners picked up seats in the parliament, indicating that whoever finally becomes prime minister will take a tougher stance on peace negotiations with the Palestinians. So where does all that leave the outlook for Middle East peace? Warren Clark is a former ambassador who is executive director of Churches for Middle East Peace. Jack Moline is the rabbi at Agudas Akim Congregation in Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Rabbi Moline, what's the outlook?
It's a little hard to tell, Bob. It could be that this could be a huge opportunity in Israeli and Palestinian relationships. Any change in circumstance, I think, presents an opportunity. And I'm hoping this is one that both sides will take.
Why? Why is it a new opportunity?
The shift in government in Israel to a government that at least has support of an electorate.
With more hardliners in the government?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. The last two prime ministers of Israel campaigned on promises to take a harder line against Palestinian statehood, and both of them turned out being, by some standard at least, the most progressive prime ministers that there were. The withdrawal from Gaza and the proclamation by Olmert that an independent Palestinian state was desirable was a surprise to everybody.
So hardliners might be able to do more toward negotiating peace?
I think you say one thing to get into office, and you find out you have to do other things once you're there.
Ambassador, what's your sense of where we are?
I would say there's another opportunity, which is a new government here in the United States. We have a new president, a new Secretary of State. The president and the secretary have appointed a new Middle East envoy, Senator Mitchell. And I think that's new. For most of the Bush administration, there was not a forward-leaning U.S. government promoting peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Although I'll tell you, one of the things that President Bush did that no other president was able to do was to call for a Palestinian state independent alongside of Israel. And I think another example of how that can happen.
But you think that's the only objective, too, right? The two-state solution?
I'm afraid anything else is going to be much worse. If you're talking about a continuation of the occupation or unilateral Israeli control, it's an invitation for endless conflict.
Mm-hmm. You know, decade after decade, American presidents, American people have tried to promote successful negotiations between Israel and its neighbors, and it never gets anywhere. And is there anything new that the new president or Senator Mitchell or anybody could think of that might had not have been tried before that might lead to some kind of breakthrough? Jack?
I'm not sure that we can say that there's been no progress. There are qualitative differences between the relationships of Israelis and Palestinians now than there were 20, 25 years ago when the Israeli government prohibited its representatives from even speaking with representatives mm-hmm. of the Palestinian nation. So progress is not happening at the rate we'd like to, and certainly the violence that's a result of that slow progress is something we all deplore. But I think that that, as I said, any change is an opportunity, and we should go with the slow momentum.
Well, it certainly is that.
It is.
But I have another concern about the situation right now and how it's different, and that's the demographic situation. The population of the Palestinians is growing faster than that in Israel. And unless there is a two-state solution pretty soon, the opportunity is really going to be lost.
What about some kind of popular movement in the Middle East, here? What can American churches do? What can the American Jewish community do? What opportunities are for pressure coming up from the bottom that might change what the governments do? Ambassador?
I would say we need to continue the kind of communication dialogue that goes on between the Christian community and the Jewish community. We try to do that here in Washington with Churches to Middle East Peace. I think there's a lot of ignorance in the United States about the tragedy in the Middle East, and that there are real opportunities for peace.
Mm-hmm. And I think you would find that that within all of the American communities, Jewish, Christian, even the American Arab community, there are clusters of people who are working very hard on a variety of levels to find some resolution. You have people who are a little more liberal looking for cooperation, people a little harder to the right looking for a more militant solution. But the variety is there. The idea is to allow those voices to rise.
Quickly, Ambassador, you've said that the window is closing on opportunity, and I assume you mean by that the Arab population is increasing so fast.
That's part of it. The other part of it is the Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories continue to expand. They've never really stopped. Every president since Nixon has said they should stop. But there's been a greater expansion since the Annapolis conference a year ago than before.
But the bottom line for both of you is that there is still some chance.
Where it's, there's life, there's hope.
It's not impossible.
Yeah. Ambassador Warren Clark, Rabbi Jack Moline, many thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
This conversation will continue on our website at pbs.org. We have a special report today on what's called open adoption. Once biological parents who chose adoption agreed to have no contact with the child later on, the identity of the birth mother was legally sealed. But now, more and more, mothers are agreeing to open adoption. No more secrecy. Is that what's best for everyone involved, for the adults and the child? Saul Gonzalez reports from Los Angeles.
It's a scene captured in countless home movies. A mother in the hospital with her newborn infant.
Oh, big yawn.
But this mom, Sarah Kastner, isn't keeping her son named Beau. 20 years old, single, and worried she's not ready to raise a child, Sarah's giving her baby up for adoption.
Okay.
Personally passing him on to his new adoptive parents just after she gives birth.
You think, oh, yeah, baby's going to be cute and everyone's going to help you, but it's like you have that child for 18 years. This kid's going to be needing to go to school. He's going to be needing to go to college. You have to do medical bills if he gets sick. And it's like there's no way right now if I'm still, like, barely supporting myself how I'm going to support this little baby and give him everything he needs in life.
Although she's giving him up, Sarah's playing a critical role in Beau's future. That's because Sarah's chosen what's called an open adoption. It allows a birth parent, often the mom, to choose the people who will adopt the child, and if she wishes, stay in contact with the adoptive parents and the child. For Beau, Sarah picked John and Lauren Halloran of Los Angeles. When they first considered adopting, after years of trying without success to have their own child, the Hallorans assumed they'd have little to no contact with their adopted child's birth parent, or even know her identity. That's called a closed adoption.
We thought, you know, the mother, she has the baby, she never sees it again. You know, cut 20 years down the road, there's this search for the birth parent,
the child could
go either really well or really badly.
Kind of like the movie of the week story.
Exactly.
Like other birth parents involved in open adoptions, Sarah reviewed dozens of personal profiles and appeals written by prospective adoptive parents before settling on the Hallorans.
How many birth parent letters did you get?
Probably like 75 to 85. Like, here's a big stack.
When you got that stack of 75 to 85, it was overwhelming?
It's like, oh my gosh, I'm going to change one of these people's lives.
Sarah was struck by the Hallorans' honesty in their letter to her.
I liked how it said, by no means are we perfect, but we want to honor your commitment of how open you want this to be. And so that was something that I really liked.
Although her legal rights as a parent have been terminated, Sarah plans on a continuing relationship with Beau and his adoptive parents. Weeks after the birth, and living 4 hours' drive away from each other, technology allows Sarah to see Beau regularly.
I think he's got to be like at least like 10 or 12 pounds now. He's getting heavy. He's ready for preschool.
I thought we weren't going to have a fat kid. What happened?
Staying in touch with Beau is important to Sarah. And not only because she's his birth mom. Sarah herself was given up for adoption when she was an infant and was raised by an adoptive family. Like many other adoptees, Sarah grew up having no contact with her birth mother. That absence created questions.
I kind of do wish I knew my birth mom growing up a little bit, just so, like, she'd check in and it's like, oh, hey. Like, because it makes it, like, feel like you weren't just given up. And, like, if the birth mom checks in on you, it's like, oh, she does care about me and she does care about my well-being. She just didn't dump me and start a new life and not ever think about me.
So that closing of the door completely between you and Beau was never an option
for
you?
Yeah, no. It wasn't.
Because?
Because I would always wonder, and I think it would, like, drive me nuts always thinking, what is he doing now? What is he going to do tomorrow? And stuff. Like, oh, is he gaining weight? Is he okay? Is everything fine with him? Yeah.
Open adoption relationships can range from an occasional exchange of photos and emails between birth parents and adoptive families to regular visits. The Hallorans believe Beau will only benefit from having contact with Sarah.
Beau will always know his birth mother. He'll always know that he was placed out of love, that it was never, ever a question of not being wanted, but more an issue of Sarah wanting more than she could provide at this time.
The open adoption movement, which started in the 1980s, has largely transformed the culture of infant adoption in the United States.
Oh, sleeping baby.
Experts say open adoptions have helped remove the anxieties of adoptive families and the shame of birth parents.
We didn't used to talk about this stuff. This was all considered secret or private. The lesson is taught.
Adam Pertman is the author of Adoption Nation and the director of a nonprofit institute that's dedicated to improving adoption practices.
So adoption schools is part of what we do. We've really transformed it, right? I mean, it has gone from a stigmatized, still too often stigmatized, very secretive process. I mean, people didn't tell their own kids they were adopted. And that was more a norm, whether they told their kids or not. It was not a subject for public conversation. To one in which it's a subject for public conversation. Normalization is the key.
Pertman cites an American Psychological Association study released last year, which concluded open adoptions helped mitigate birth parents' feelings of pain and loss. But some in the adoption community believe there's still a place for secrecy, sometimes because the birth parent wants to remain anonymous, other times because of safety.
Are there occasions where it is a good thing to simply close the door on the biological parents or the biological mother?
Yes, absolutely, and we'll work with the child's attorney to say either it happens in a counseling setting or it doesn't happen at all.
Carrie Dunkelberger is the director of adoption and foster care programs for Olive Crest, a charity that works to place often abused children with families. Although she supports open adoption, she says some birth parents are simply too dangerous to have contact with adoptive families.
We want the child to have as much information around that experience and honest information as possible, but there are case scenarios where either there's an incarceration or it's not a safe family, or it would somehow put the children or the entire family at risk where the biological family cannot be included.
Because the biological family could be a threat to the child.
Right.
Or to the adoptive
right.
parent.
Sarah Kastner feels too many people still believe birth parents who give up their child for adoption do it out of neglect or apathy.
You give him up for adoption out of love, not out of, like, selfishness that you just don't want to be responsible. And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand. Like, I've had to explain that a lot. I've benefited so much from being adopted, and so I know Beau's going to benefit. Nothing bad could come from adoption.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles.
Especially since 9/11, many Christian and Muslim leaders have been getting together to deepen their mutual understanding. Now, Fred DeSam Lazaro has found a church in Nigeria that's going well beyond interfaith dialogue. It actually combines Christian and Muslim worship practices and teachings. Its pastor calls it Chrislam.
Nigerians may want for many of life's basic needs. A house of worship would not seem to be one of them. In the largest city, Lagos, there are traditional old-line churches, but there are also hundreds of banners and posters that invite worshipers to newer, smaller congregations. None is more unusual than this one, both Christian and Muslim.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
The lectern holds both Quran and Bible, and invocations come loudly from both. Roughly half of Nigeria's 140 million people are Muslim. The other half profess some form of Christianity. It's been a political fault line over the years, and tensions have often erupted in deadly violence. Just last November, more than 300 people were killed in the northern city of Jos.
Listen to me. I want you to realize that Abraham had many children.
But the 1,500 or so practitioners of what their preacher calls Chrislam see no religious fault line between the two faiths. Shamsuddin Saka, he's called prophet, tells his audience they are all children of Abraham through Judeo-Christian tradition and through Islam.
Abraham is a father of Christianity, a father of Islam. Why the Christian and Muslim are fighting?
Saka was born Muslim, and it was after returning from a Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca that he was inspired, he says, instructed by God, to launch his new ministry.
And that's about 19 years ago. Then there is a lot of people killing themselves in Nigeria in 19 years ago. I was praying and I lie down, and the Lord told me, when you get to your country, make a peace between Christian and Muslim.
He said he's written letters to political leaders and traveled to affected areas when religious violence has broken out, urging reconciliation around common beliefs. But Saka's most visible impact is in his immediate neighborhood, where he has brought the faiths together in a blended liturgy. It begins each Sunday morning with Quranic prayer in an open floor that, like a mosque, has no pews. These then give way to prayer with the congregation seated in chairs. Well, sometimes seated. This prayer is intense, a trance-like frenzy similar to a Pentecostal Christian service. It reaches a climax with a sermon from Saka that on this day took almost 2 hours.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
As different as Christianity and Islam are, there is some common ground.
The Bible, you know, concentrates on teachings of love. That's what Jesus, alayhi salatu wasalam, says in Matthew chapter 5, that you love your neighbor, and you even love your enemy. Now you find the Quran saying exactly the same thing.
The Quran says the same thing.
Yes, pay evil back with goodness. If you do that, those who used to hate you before, those who were your enemies before, will soon become your friends. So, Bible, Quran are saying the same thing.
Islam was brought to West Africa by Arab traders 10 centuries ago, Christianity by European colonization starting around the 15th century. Each has been interpreted and adapted to local customs, and that's apparent in the way Islam is sometimes practiced.
According to Islam, the Prophet Muhammad was the final prophet, but certainly not the only prophet, and they believe in Jesus and all of the other prophets of Judaism and Christianity that came before the Prophet Muhammad. So it's nothing foreign to a Muslim to believe in Jesus, to pray in Jesus or some of the other prophets, to light a candle for the Virgin Mary, for example, as I've experienced Muslims do in churches in Senegal. They believe in some cases in various African countries of what I've called a spirituality without boundaries.
In a land where spirituality is a dominant force in people's lives, she says economic hardships may also push people to try new ideas. Nigeria has vast oil wealth, but only a few have benefited. Per capita income is about $850 a year, for example, and life expectancy a mere 45 years.
If they're poor, if they're suffering from HIV/AIDS, if they're trying to understand a changing political situation, finding a new religion is one way of coping with the situation, of looking for new leadership, of trying to have control on their own through prayer, through different rituals, of something that may not necessarily be controllable.
Many who come to Chrislam are praying for what Saka calls deliverance, from illness, for example. Kawa Khaled Adakunji, who was born Muslim, came to Chrislam 15 years ago when she couldn't have children.
I now have children. I came and saw that miracles are performed here. Those who didn't have children have children. Those who were lame are walking, and the blind are now seeing.
At the service, there are petitions for miracles of health and wealth, or at least improved finances.
Delay is not denied.
Delay is not denial, Saka tells his congregants as he urges prayer and patience. Some people do come up to testify to miracles in their lives, a child conceived or a business deal. Such deliverance is mostly associated with Christian churches, but Saka says it's not foreign to Islam.
Islam is a religion of peace, of love, of miracle. When you're talking about miracle, Islam is a miracle itself. The founding of the Quran himself is a miracle.
And congregants have taken to heart Saka's message that to get back, one must first give. But he denies that he personally benefits from these gifts. His fortune came long before the call to ministry, he says, from a real estate business. The Hummer he drives was a gift from 2 followers whose petitions were answered.
Do you like it?
One miracle even the skeptics give Saka is this congregation and how people see themselves.
Are you Christian or Muslim now?
No. Whatever you call me, I am.
Saka's Chrislam is not widespread, but even the skeptics say he's discovered the innate tolerance that's often overshadowed by violence across religious lines in a service that's part Muslim, part Christian, and wholly West African. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Lagos, Nigeria.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more on religion and politics on our One Nation page. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from this week's Lantern Festival in Taiwan, which concluded celebrations of the Chinese New Year.